I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Food USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
It is Sunday, and it's the main course on Heritage Radio Network. Can you hear me, Matt? Okay, because I can't hear me. this is the Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and my partner in crime, Patrick, will be arriving shortly.
Thanks. Hey, Katie.
Hey.
It's episode 75.
Really?
It's exciting.
Wow. I think we've gotten better. What do you think, Jack?
Biggest improvement probably from show 70 to 71. But, you know, no big deal.
Thanks, Jack. That's really encouraging. That must be making our guest today, Matt Weingarten, feel really like he's in good hands here. Anyway, so Patrick will be along shortly. But in the meantime, we have Matt Weingarten in the studio. And Matt's... microphone is about to get hooked up, so that's good. Man, we really, what happened today? It's like Mercury is so totally in retrograde. Our show today is sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards & Son, as you heard before, and you can check out their website or order through our website at Heritage Foods USA for the holidays. They've got some great stuff. And so, Matt, let us jump immediately into, first give us a brief CV, like where you are and how you got there, and then let's talk a little bit about institutional dining, not as it relates to your restaurant particularly, but as it relates to Sodexo as a whole.
Okay, great. Well, I'm the executive chef at Inside Park at St. Bart's in Manhattan, right in Midtown, and that is a restaurant that we opened about 2.5-3 years ago, and we being Sodexo and myself as a chef there, I was hired by Sodexo to start this restaurant there, and a large focus of that is sustainable and community-oriented, it being a sustainable and community-oriented restaurant. It's on the property of a beautiful landmark, St. Bartholomew's Church, so they are a partner in the venture, and it's been a great success story so far.
It's sort of in a tent, right?
Well, no, it's not in a tent. We have
But you have the outside in the summertime.
We have the outside in the summertime. Sometimes it is tented, and we have a beautiful landmark space on the inside of the the space, which is which was formerly the Great Hall for the church, and we've transformed it into a dining room, and it's really, you know, it's a rare beauty in the city. It's really lovely. And then, of course, in the summertime, we have a wonderful terrace out front that's about 200 people.
That's big.
Yeah, it's huge. It's a in the summer it is definitely high volume dining all summer long.
And you must do a huge lunch business too.
A huge.
Yeah, because you're right there.
It's great. It's really an oasis. Sort of, you're in Midtown and you can kind of sit outside underneath the palm trees and eat some delicious food and just sort of forget that you're in a canyon of Midtown buildings.
Yeah, and you are. Although you're on Park Avenue, so it's not quite as oppressive as it might be. Well, to cut right to the chase, I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on, Matt, was because we have, over the past few weeks, we've had guests on from Restaurant Associates. We had a guest on from, it was Restaurant Associates, and I forget who our other guest was at this particular moment. My apologies. But anyway, we've been talking about institutional dining and institutional sourcing, the idea being that you guys, Sodexo especially, is a company that services many, many college and university campuses, for example, as well as corporate dining rooms, mm-hmm. Is sort of a good place to start when you're talking about how a company like yours can encourage the movement, so to speak, to grow. And so I noticed on the Sodexo website, which I read pretty extensively.
Wow.
yeah, well, I try to be a little prepared, man.
That's good.
You know, it's bad enough that I can never remember anything once I've read it. But they have something called the Better Tomorrow Plan. And I wondered if you would be able to sort of outline some of the broad strokes of what the Better Tomorrow Plan means in terms of being a restaurant company that supplies so many different venues, and then sort of how the impact that that would have on the communities that you work with and the farmers that you work with.
Sure, that'd be great. So the Better Tomorrow Plan is 14 commitments. I won't recite all 14 commitments to you, but basically what's great about it is it's a very broad stroke that hits on sort of all points of our interactions as a society. So the food sustainability piece, as it depends on the food we source, is a big part of that. There are commitments towards sourcing sustainable seafood, sourcing more local produce, etc. And then there are also commitments that have to do with waste management, energy management,
water usage.
Usage is huge. So what one of the main reasons why I love working for the company is it's very broad picture. There's a lot of stories that are just beyond sort of finding that beautiful local carrot.
Sorry, here's Patrick.
Patrick just rolled in,
coming in at a dead run. What the hell happened, dude? Well, I mean, I know that we had fall back. Oh, look,
he failed at the clock switching. So,
but the clock switching was falling back. You would have been an hour early.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's our show, guys. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
This
for a loop. Oh, you poor thing. Well, anyway, we just got started, Patrick. So, Matt was just outlining for us some of the main sort of the four major commitments of the
Sodexo
Better
Group.
Tomorrow Plan, which is as outlined by the Sodexo Group. And also, I did manage to retrieve from the memory banks that it was Bon Appetit Catering Company that we had as another guest again to talk
Bon
about.
And
Restaurant Associates, and now Sodexo.
I'll tell you, Bon Appetit sounded very impressive. Restaurant Associates seemed to say the right words, but I didn't quite get the names of the farms or the percentage. Bon Appetit is a lot about that.
Well, I think they are, and I think that they make that very much up front and center. I think with Restaurant Associates, it's a little bit more of a, catering to their dining groups that they work with, but with less of a sort of sense of urgency about it. Mm-hmm. Clearly, Sodexo has a very strong sort of corporate responsibility element to the company, and so Matt was just kind of getting into like its waste management, its water usage, its sourcing locally, and what was the fourth one that you mentioned?
Energy management.
Energy
management is huge. So it's really, I mean, for myself, I mean, I come from obviously the culinary side. I'm constantly, getting more educated myself, and that's real. It's a personal benefit to me as I'm more involved with our corporate citizenship team and our sustainability team, as you know, the information that I'm able to, have better access to and to be able to think about more. Whereas sort of if you're just operating, you know, in a dark basement kitchen, you're worried about, like I said, where that beautiful carrot comes from, but you're not really thinking about your water usage. You're not really thinking about, you know, how efficient your kitchen is actually running. And one of the things that is a big focus, especially in the campuses right now, is actually on food waste that the company is making for, which has been a real eye opener for me. And I think it's an amazing stance. And basically, it's a focus to sort of just minimize waste and to look at both ends of how that's contributing to greenhouse gases, both on the producing end and then also on the disposal end. And so,
well, I was fascinated when I was watching the sort of corporate statement on the website that the guy who was giving the statement was talking about how they had actually sent a chef in to an American university into a public school,
mm-hmm.
and had told the kids, like, explained to them that all this food that they were throwing out in the public school system actually had an impact on their environment, on you know, waste management, and also that it was
that's
just
a good
kind of
thing
a criminal.
To tell the kids in public schools eat more.
Well, but I mean, you know, well, the idea that you're but what's happening in public schools is like everybody is working so hard to make the food better, and yet the kids, like, you put an apple on a child's tray and they toss it.
Right.
Well, by the way, just to jump in with a good point, since I ridiculously missed the first 50 minutes, which I've never done.
Well, we started 5 minutes late, so don't worry.
You know, I really am getting sick of the school talk. Mm-hmm. The school talk right now is a no-win situation financially. So why are we talking about it? There's 3,000 corporate cafeterias before schools. Ball fields.
Well, and also there are all those
But the New York Times building, all newspaper buildings, movie complexes. What are the craft tables serving at every movie thing? Those people have the power tomorrow to change. But everyone's like, oh, that's too direct. Let's talk about that thing. So you say, oh, I want to help a public school. That makes me sustainable. It actually, I think, makes it ridiculous. Now, there could be a school or two. What about every private school in America? That's a winnable battle that we could start tomorrow, but no one wants to fight that battle because it would involve getting the driver to drive up to the back of the school in 5 days. Anyway, sometimes I think too much energy is put on that. Meanwhile, there are culinary crimes being committed at people who have a lot of money. You know what I mean? So anyway, that's just a personal thing. I think school lunch sounds great, but...
Oh, yeah. It's a really easy cause to get behind. There's no question about
right.
it.
Because and it's so winless. Yeah. There's so
well,
little
action. But
and
also it's like any rhetoric you make around that issue is going to make you look like a hero.
Right.
No matter how little you actually accomplish in changing things. But let's go back to the college and university mm-hmm. level, because that
yes,
is someplace where you
place.
Really... How many colleges and universities is Sodexo working with?
And how many meals a year or a month or something?
I don't have those figures. I'm sorry, guys. I'm not.
I will tell you
team.
That it's. Yeah. It's. I know that Sodexo employs nearly 400,000 mm-hmm. people. That they're in, I think, 33 countries, and it's. I forget. I have not retained the figure of how many colleges it is, but it's in the hundreds
right.
of universities. So that if you think about how many kids are going to universities and that a university campus might be serving, I don't know, you know, 5,000 meals a day at least,
right.
that's where you have an opportunity to actually
yes.
change the way kids think about food and what they do with it. So let's talk.
Yeah,
let,
no,
let me let
I mean,
you pick up that thread again.
Right.
And
while I mean, Patrick, while I definitely agree with you of the winless battle of sort of at the school lunch level, I mean, a big part of it is the education level, and the idea is that, you know, you learn certain things in your education level besides just, you know, your grammar and math and what you're taking with you into your own workplace. So, you know, the thought and the hope, my personal hope, is that as people are exposed to it at grade school level, and even more so at college level, that when they go to work for their to big money, big corporation, that they have certain expectations of what their company finds acceptable and what they're willing to pay for, et cetera. Because that's the key, especially on the food service end. I mean, Sodexo, we are a food service based company, meaning that we will provide any service that any company wants, period.
And the range of services is big special events to breakfast.
Right.
To
I mean, there's the food service side, but it's actually service management. There's also, you know, building management as well, and that's where we get into the energy side of it. But it's, you know, it's from the what's at your cafeteria to also how your building's functioning, et cetera. Any real services. We're really the focus of the company moving forward is really to get into services that any services that affect people when they come together. You know, mm-hmm. any community based services. So the idea is that Sodexo will provide any services a company requires, and the other side of that is the company has to be willing to pay for it. I mean, whether it's corporate services or whether it's school lunch, or whether it's just you and I going to the supermarket to buy food, you know, we all have a pretty good understanding that we've lost the cost for a cost relation ratio, that it's cheap, but what are the real costs? And mm-hmm. so
they sign off by binding with Sodexo. They just trust that you're going to get them a competitive price for what they're demanding.
But let's talk about how you get that competitive price, because if you're leveraging that much buying power, how does that translate into, you know, revitalizing a rural economy.
And where is Sodexo buying from? I mean, we were even, Bon Appetit was like, you know, of course we have to rely on the commodity market. I mean, right. Are you kidding? We're a massive company,
right.
and this and that, but we are trying to move in this direction. So speak to that a little
right.
bit.
Well, so, you know, we are also in buying that same system. And what Sodexo is currently doing is putting a lot of pressure on many of our traditional procurement resources for them to get better, and that we're still going to them as our main number one sourcing, but we want them to be buying more local and more sustainably as well. Because another big issue of the purchasing is the liability involved and et cetera. So the idea of someone coming in the back of a truck with a bunch of potatoes, which I've done in small restaurants, is a little less applicable for the scale, sure. Because we live in a litigious society, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if we can get those regional, larger, our traditional sources to say, we want you to buy from this farmer, we want you to buy from this farmer, we want you to buy from this farmer, and it represents our buying power, that's an amazing way to sort of shape the discussion.
So do you work with like the big broadline distributors like Sysco and US Foods and stuff like that?
Yes,
and so correct. You're able to tell them.
Exactly.
But then
care?
Yeah, they do because this is a huge client.
They do care
because they're gonna lose money if they don't.
They absolutely care. I mean that Walmart's all local now. I mean everybody cares. So it is, you know, I'm personally frustrated. I'm sure everybody sitting here is personally frustrated, but I mean there clearly is some movement at this point from 5 years ago.
Even. I don't feel frustrated at all. I think it's great. I think what's happening.
Been like, oh, that's BS. But now as a businessman, I mean, you can't but appreciate that move, whether they're doing it for the right reasons or not. An inch by Walmart is equivalent to, sure. you know, 900 truckloads into the city.
Matt, when you talk about, when we talk about farmers, though, one of the things that Patrick and I have discovered over and over again when we talk to smaller distributors or smaller, you know, independent farms, is that they have no distribution network, they have no aggregation or processing facilities, no aggregation warehouses where somebody like a Sysco can come up and pick up a whole right. pallet or a whole truckload of potatoes
Heritage
or apples
has,
or whatever.
For instance, Pat LaFrieda, who has 30 trucks out there, right. and they allow us
So without access to that kind of basic transportation and distribution, it can't be that easy to get these guys into the fold.
I'm gonna call out to all young entrepreneurs. That is a key part of the
Did you get that tag, Jack? Yes. A call to entrepreneurs.
Well, we said that before. Really? It's like, where are the venture capitalists?
That's the puzzle piece,
it's
right there.
It's just a van. You know, a truck. It's something. I'm just saying, it's not brain science.
No, but exactly.
It might involve a lot of infrastructure, but it's about making a delivery in a vehicle to a place and giving them a packing slip
right.
and an invoice.
Right.
Well, I mean, somebody has to take the farmer's, you know, apples or potatoes or beets and clean them off and bunch right. them up
there's,
and pack
there's
them in a
case.
There's
such population density in New York. Everybody knows everybody. People are very in their own little world, or they have their thing, you know what I mean? So it's very hard for someone to break in like Sullivan County or, you know, Westchester County or New Jersey. But, you know, if you look towards maybe a more regional approach, Virginia, North Carolina, I mean, those places would really benefit if 50 farms signed up to some distribution
entity. Well, if 50 farms were able to come together and get some sort of, you know, government money to help them build a processing facility
Absolutely
where
right.
a truck could pull up and get the stuff,
right?
That would be, you know, an enormous step forward in creating regional networks of you know, distribution, whether it's meat or produce and cereals.
Sodexo ever thought of becoming vertically integrated like that? Like, no, I first want to ask this. You have an unusual role within Sodexo.
Somewhat.
In that you're kind of like a guinea pig. You guinea pig ideas, you know,
right.
you test things out to see how feasible or what works and what doesn't on that kind of fringe cutting edge tip
right.
of the wave.
I'm part of a task force that's dedicated to doing this beyond my traditional role of being a chef at Inside Park at St. Bart's. So you know, we're really trying to find the solutions because, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, like I said, everybody wants to get that great carrot in wherever you are, whether it's school, whether it's restaurant, whether it's cafeteria. but how does that, you know, how is that financially sustainable, and how does the whole distribution work, and how do we ensure safety in every step of the way? So, you know, I don't think guinea pigs are the right term.
But what are you doing though? You were doing things, and then you report up.
Correct.
And then that might become a policy change through the organization.
Yes, correct. For lack of
it's very impressive.
Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of other people in the company that are also involved at different ends, from the, you know, corporate citizenship team to you know, discussing the waste management. But this is, you know, this is huge for the company, and it's one of the reasons why I sort of was originally attracted to Sodexo after working in sort of small restaurants.
Savoy,
you know, I was, you know, cooking in the...
You were in charge of that kitchen.
Yes.
You didn't even let Peter anywhere near there.
No, that's not true. Peter and I had a you know, phenomenal collaboration, and, you know, and it's actually sort of an interesting story to tell, because I was, you know, I was cooking in a small kitchen, and you know, Peter's just, you know, he sets the gold standard for you know, sourcing and his knowledge base for where
bicycles.
Food comes from, et cetera. But, you know, I was really interested in what it, you know, the possibilities of doing it at a larger scale, and sort of like, yeah. You know, like you said, it's a, you
institutional
know,
change.
It's, a, you know, it's an amazing opportunity. So,
well, we just, Heritage is really psyched. We're working with Virginia Tech.
Amazing.
Through our farmer friend Alec Bradford in Virginia, and we're also work with Emory University,
right,
which is a Sodexo account, right. I believe.
And right, they're buying your turkeys, right?
Yeah, they're all buying our turkeys and our ground turkey, and so you know, that was a lot. It was Matt who went through
helped
the patient process
that.
To get in, because that's what it is. It's basically they make it hard to start. But then once you've started...
Well, I was going to ask about that,
actually. We should take
but we're going to take a short break
and I just want to say
right
Matt is one
Matt
of my...
Weingarten.
I'm going to say this at the beginning of the next segment about what a great chef I think he is. And I'm not you. Just saying that, because I don't... We have chefs on here all
yeah,
the time, and I say they're good. But there's some stuff Matt does in particular that I find particularly unique, and the cured meats plot in particular. So we'll be right back. Who's our sponsor today?
Edwards.
Oh,
as well
nice.
As Edwards.
Sam.
Sarah, girl.
Oh, I think we're on the air now.
Oh. We are on the air.
This is the main course.
My brain is like sriracha. I also ran 5 miles today.
This morning?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought I woke you up.
No, you. Well, it sounded like it. So yeah, you know,
you sounded very discombobulated. But let's remind our listeners that this is the main course on
broadcasting
Heritage
out of Roberta's
Radio Network
restaurant.
I'm Katie Kiefer, and you're Patrick Martins. And our guest in studio right now is Matt Weingarten.
We're gonna have Josh Sharkey from Bark, Chris Paracchini, the visionary at Roberta's.
Behind Roberta's, yeah.
Then we're also gonna have a drop by visit of Alec Bradford,
hooray,
miraculously
who delivered turkeys,
slaughtered 1,800 turkeys. Friday.
Not himself.
And we're going to get the... Well, he had to put all 1,800 on the trucks. And that's a bloody business because those turkeys really fight back.
Right. Oh, come on.
So anyway, I'm a big fan of Cafe St. Bart's. I mean, first of all, it's in a church, which is cool, but
it's
from
not
the
called
food
Cafe St. Bart's. Let's
I
name
it
correctly, shall we?
It's not Cafe St.
Bart's? It's Inside
Bart's?
Park at St. Bart's. But
okay.
Inside Park at St. Bart's.
Yeah. I love the little... what is those little... they're not Tupperware. They're those little...
Ceramic
cooking things that
they're
you can put in the...
Crabs, ramekins?
Yes. Yeah. It's either La Croisette or style.
La Croisette. Right. Oh. And you put those into 500 things. So there's a whole series of those little things. They're little lodge... pots, you know, with
oh yeah, I love those little miniature things.
And his charcuterie plate, as a kind of experimenter, has cured things in it that basically you don't see anymore. I think you had elk,
right?
And bison, carpaccio, and
right.
All that.
I've been known to get some interesting meats and do very traditional preparations of it. I mean, I'm really
hunters bear. Did
yeah,
you have
well,
bear?
That was just for you. That's not on the menu, but
because it's legal to hunt bear.
It's legal to hunt bear, but it's not legal to sell it. So I just gave you a taste.
Oh, okay, sorry.
No, it's fine. No, I mean that's literally what it was. I have a very good friend who's a very avid hunter, Steve Rinella. He's actually would be a great candidate for the show. He does a lot of. He's written a couple books. But basically, you know, big focus of the restaurant is just heritage cuisine. And for me, that means, you know, really holding on to a lot of our traditional culinary knowledge and sort of celebrating it. You know, it doesn't have to be molecular and come in a spheroid, you know, ball and have foam on it to be delicious. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, there's just sort of this idea of, I mean, and what I think is a key to, you know, our current food problems is... a rethinking of what it means to eat, and if you look at any traditional cuisine anywhere in the world, you know the ratios of protein to starch to vegetable are 99% in order because that was sustainable. There's the reasons why, you know, a recipe doesn't last, you know, doesn't live for 500 years if it's not sustainable.
So meaning what, for instance, nutritionally or it's not too much meat?
Economically as well.
Nutritionally, economically, you know, as far as, you know, agriculturally, everything. I mean, you look at, you know, a simple dish like cassoulet. Like, why does cassoulet exist? It exists because, you know, in that particular region of France, those particular game birds and a pig or two happen to be able to live off the land, and there's beans aplenty, and you need the fat to get you through the winter, and everything is in order. You know, it's not, you know, you don't get this huge, you don't get a whole duck and a little bit of beans. You get a little bit of duck and a lot of beans. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's just one example. But
and actually, that dish has iterations through so many different cultures because it's basically the same thing as cholent.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same as cholent. I mean,
so that's all through the pale and through
Katie,
Russia.
You know so much. It's
well,
amazing.
I know a lot about food.
About
honey.
Food.
She does, yes.
I'm not talking about sports.
Yeah, exactly. I was just asking Matt, like, why does anybody care about the marathon?
Sometimes our guests try to test us, then that basically unleashes a whole whirlwind of info from Katie.
Yeah, no, cholent's the same thing. I mean, but you know these traditional dishes. If you start looking back at them, and that's kind of one of the focuses that Sodexo's taking is to bring these traditional dishes and this traditional style of eating and thinking about food into the cafeteria so that we can get away from, you know...
From a burger and fries.
Burger and fries, exactly.
Can you describe the chefs within the Sodexo, the people that are running and making the actual culinary gastronomic decisions at each one of these venues... Where do they come from? You know, have they gotten the chance to go to the Chez Panisses, to the Babos of the world and study, or are they coming from like what is their mandate?
Yeah. No, I mean they're culinary trained and it's an enormous company. So you have all skill sets. And another interesting thing too. So some of them are you know very highly culinary trained, and some of them are less culinary trained and are very good on the service end. And the interesting thing is a lot of the accounts where Sodexo services, they don't have, you know, a lot of them have a small pantry and you have electric burners, and that's what is there at the facility, and you're still challenged with making delicious food for a very, you know, captive audience that needs, you know, great sustenance in their workplace. So you have to take that into consideration when you see sort of what, you know, what culinary talent and what the culinary program is at each of those different levels are. And you know, what Sodexo does really well is provide solutions to those kind of issues. I mean, you know, the big tagline that you see, there's a video, you see, you know, we service in Antarctica and we service on oil wells. So there's really, you know, there's lots of challenges that the company does really well.
Very interesting.
Oh yeah, it's great. It's a great company. I mean, when you look at the website, it's really, there's so much going on there, and I was so impressed with this whole
great
sort of corporate citizenship part,
yeah,
and the whole, you know, Better Tomorrow plan,
and all of these little steps
that they're taking to change things. But before you ask your question, Patrick, I just wanted to say one thing, or ask one thing of Matt, and that is when you guys say you take over a corporate dining facility and do you find that the people that are used to eating there, are they like open to and excited about changes? Do they have an opportunity to make suggestions, or is it an uphill battle? I mean, outside of the New York area, because obviously you guys, and let's talk only about the United States because we're the most food challenged nation in the world, as far as I'm concerned. So let's stick to like the smaller cities.
More than Ethiopia?
Well, food challenge in the sense of like
abundance, but
of abundance, but
it.
Crappy food.
Right.
Abundant crappy food. Yeah.
Just kidding.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting point, because I think one of the great things that's going on right now is companies, corporate boardrooms are mandating we're going to change the food that we're providing for our guests, which is for our employees. Excuse me, which is wonderful. However, you know, on the field, on the boots, it's sometimes more challenging. Sometimes, you know, they want a massive platter of, you know, fried chicken and macaroni and cheese or whatever. It could be delicious, could not be delicious, but that's really the challenge.
To.
I mean, there's definitely open to change, but you know, like anything, there's any change in any workplace. Is challenging, and what one thing that Sodexo has been working on for the last couple of years is studying demographics in all sorts of different arenas, from call centers to traditional, you know, to factories, to traditional business headquarters, and really trying to understand what the demographic is and provide them with the best possible choices of food that's going to not only attract them, but that's going to be able to allow the companies that are hiring us to achieve their own goals. So,
which is like interesting. You know, it goes back a long way. I always remember Captain Bligh was sent to the West Indies to bring breadfruit back to feed the slaves.
Yeah.
But the slaves didn't like eat them in the end.
Right,
like
right.
Finally, when they
got
there,
want
it was just
breadfruit.
So it is supposed to be a culturally adapted food, or else, you know, you're starting off.
Well, what
on the
I
wrong
think
foot.
Is interesting is to take that piece of the up. Of the boardroom. You know, mandating these changes and asking for these demographic studies. And then to me, I think to myself, well, what is it about that makes it work for them? And I'm thinking, well, it's the economics. Because if you have a lot of overweight people who have a lot of health issues, then you're talking about lost work, lost wage, you know. And so does it really all come back to that on a certain level? It's
right. And it absolutely does. And part of what our corporate citizenship team is working on is being able to quantify the changes we're making, creating quantifiable scales that then you can take to your, I mean, it's not just the productivity, which is a huge part, and the health and wellness, but it's also the healthcare piece as well, clearly.
Yeah.
So I think that that is also, I'll make another call to entrepreneurs,
nice.
Understanding what the correlations between cost of healthcare services and the food provided, and having some sort of new model, new scale that's going to really understand that, so that you know, basically the money has to be found somewhere for the more responsibly sourced or you know, a more complicated distribution change. All those things are added costs in. So the money has to be found somewhere. So if you're able to find that money on the back end of your healthcare costs that are becoming exorbitant, it makes it feasible for the companies that are hiring us, as well as it makes them a more attractive company for their future recruits. Because, you know, to go back to the grade school level, the university level, that the thought is that, you know, the most educated, you know, potential employees will be demanding that. So
right.
That's how I see the whole.
Very interesting. You know, I like this call out to entrepreneurs, because that's really what it takes. It takes business people to do something.
It does.
The reason there's not enough slaughterhouses in upstate New York is because investment is not coming into that sector.
And the same with the concept of the aggregation warehouse, the processing facilities in order to bring the distribution networks in line. I mean, without those pieces of the puzzle, you can talk about this locavore, you know, stuff all you want.
Right.
So but what it ain't going to happen. Your 10-year vision or 25-year vision,
and they
for
have
your
one.
Work in terms of right. you, what it, you're pushing. I don't it, care. I mean, I know what theirs is, but I'm saying, like, you might even take that vision further.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, my vision is to create a financially sustainable and stable model to deal with specifically distribution chains of local farmers and local foods into a larger corporation such as Sodexo. And we're doing great work. We're getting, you know, we're making progress. And, you know, is 10 years, you know, a realistic aim? Yeah, you know, it's a big it's, you know, it's a big ship, you know, and it's a big ship that everything is very well vetted, which is, you know, you could, depending on who's looking at the progress from external, if you're looking for, you know, just the quick, you know, pop-up market, you know, win, they're not as frequent. But the changes, when Sodexo makes a change, it's monumental,
yeah, it's
and
big.
It's very well vetted, and it's gone through all sorts of, you know, financial and distribution. It's got, everything gets vetted out, and so when the change is made, it's very impactful, and it's not just sort of, you know, fluff, which I find, you know, very reassuring to know on such a 10-year plan thing. So,
yeah, there's an honest commitment there.
Yeah, oh no, it's fantastic. I mean,
so where can people eat Sodexo food? I mean, person, is there a place? I mean, there's.
Well, there's your restaurant.
There's my restaurant for sure. Inside Park.
Is that open in the winter?
We're open. We're
just
open
the outside.
365 days of the year. Yeah.
No, they're open on the outside.
Yeah. Outside is not.
The terrace is. We just closed.
Terrace is magical.
Yeah. We just closed the terrace, but we're serving. You know, the restaurant inside is open all winter long. So there's that, and then, you know, basically, I don't know all the different places, but you know. Tons of university and college campuses, lots of schools, and
do the Yankees?
And we do not do that stadium, but lots of locations.
That's awesome.
I think you can go to the website.
Yeah,
and
you
just
can go
type
to the
in S O D E X O.
Yes,
and you will learn right. everything you ever wanted to know about Sodexo, except for right. about Matt Weingarten.
Right. What is the chain that you report to? We have 4 minutes left,
okay.
But tell us, what is the chain? So you make an observation or find some way of saving energy, and then what do you do?
Well, I'm like I said earlier, I'm on a special task force that I'm bringing that information to in order to create a new model, a new program, which will be rolling out in some sort of beta phase very soon, in sort of a very well thought out phase, and that'll go into a couple different locations that we're determining. So there is a team that consists of people from the company. And this is the director, you know, this is, you know, we report directly to Michael Norris, the president. And this was his directive. He put this team together. So there are marketing people on that team. There's culinary, myself. There is the, you know, health and wellness side of the on that team. There is financial. There's procurement. There is...
Energy.
That's water. Sort of under, energy and water. That's all sort of under the energy management, our corporate citizenship team. I'm trying to think of who else I've left out, but pretty much all facets to make it a successful program.
And what percentage of the food is being sourced according to what you would consider? It's arrived. Like it gets a check. You wouldn't change it, and you hope to see more of it.
You know, I would say, you know, depending on this. I mean. And in the Northeast, you know, where we are, is we're not in Berkeley, California. In the Northeast, I would say, you know, we're working, especially on the produce end, our traditional vendors are doing a very good job. I mean, I think that there is, you know, in the growing season, there are choices that you can do, you know, probably you can get 30-40% of your produce locally.
Wow. That's a good number.
You know,
30-40% is millions of pounds.
Which doesn't mean that that's what's happening in all the accounts, but it is available. Right.
With all the foods, because meats harder.
And if the companies that have hired us are willing to pay that, you know, it's usually a premium. If you're willing to pay for the premium, yeah, we'll provide it, you know. And that is the key, you know. We always need partnerships to drive the issue. On the meat side, it's a little more challenging. It's complicated.
It's not everyone can be like Heritage.
Yeah, but as part of the challenge, it is obviously the cost factor. And so, do you think that if these distribution networks existed, or these, you know, processing facilities, whether they're slaughterhouses or processing for produce, if those things existed regionally, would that, do you think, bring the cost down overall for companies like Sodexo?
100% cost. It's cost and liability. It's also it's understanding what it's having a new understanding of what the real risk is involved to procure that food, and understand how that can be managed from a food safety and sanitation side.
Right.
And so, you know, Sodexo itself is protected, and everybody that we serve is protected.
And the consumers, right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, we've got to have Matt back on because...
Yeah, there's so much more to this.
We didn't even talk
terrific,
about bidding.
Matt, thank you so
you
much.
You know how the Sodexo
yeah,
bid
I was
gonna against
say,
other
I wanted
companies.
To know how people got contracts with
oh,
you.
We also didn't talk about the menu. We didn't get into the nitty-gritty of how do you save energy, what could other right.
And water
do?
Usage, which water. Is obviously going to be the right. next really,
really just
big
the surface.
Thing that people
so we're
going
to have to pay
on.
For your lunch again and have you back. Yeah. Actually, Roberta's donates the lunch, for the very
But we'll buy you
guests.
An extra beer.
All right, I'll take that.
But, you know, you'll be tagged, obviously, on our Heritage Radio Network site by Jack, which means you'll have... there'll be some misspellings, but for the
oh,
most
stop.
Part...
stop! Today's our 75th show, Patrick. Did you know
75th
that?
Show. Yeah. You look great for 75,
I'm
Katie.
Telling you. 75? I'm 102.
So we're going to be back with really a guy I look up to, Chris Paracchini, the visionary behind Roberta's. And then we're going to come in with Josh Sharkey. And
then, no, at 110, we have Tim Carman from the Washington City Paper inaugurating our
I think
little...
he's 120 now, based
okay.
off of the number of guests.
I guess
and my
that's
lateness,
what's
going to
happen.
Tim, I'm sorry.
Jack, you're
going to
call
punk.
Him and tell him. Matt Weingarten, thank you very much
yep.
for joining us today.
Thank you so
on
much.
Course.
Big fan.
Come back.
Come on down, there's folks that you can follow. Through the trees and marshes, place are dancing in the holler. We'll be right back. My grandma and my grandpa danced all through heaven's door. But sometimes in the moonlight you still can hear the laughter and the music of Holland fills the starry sky.
Cherry Holmes. I love Cherry Holmes.
That was great. And this is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting from the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street.
Which was built by our next guest.
Our next guest.
Chris Paracchini.
That's right.
Who, what's up, everybody?
Yeah, you're one of the owners, one of the...
He's the visionary.
The visionary. You're the DIY guy.
Yeah.
You're the guy who makes it happen.
One of them.
Yeah, that's true.
He did it completely himself.
You guys are an amazing crew, actually. I'm just full of admiration. I mean, you know, no sooner is an idea articulated when, boom, it's done. Yeah,
we're gonna
sell pizza down at the blah, blah, blah. The next thing I know, you've got like a trailer hitch with a platform and some crazy looking little oven on it. You're dragging that around doing stuff.
So how do you get so many people to, you know, they remain independent and they keep their own style and they bring their own culture to the game, but that... yet they're still working for a cause, almost like it's a corporation, you know, like IBM, and yet it's also like a compound. How do you let people be themselves but also stay focused on a cause?
I don't know. There's like no one thing to say about it. It's a business. I mean, it's grown into a business in a way that it wasn't in the early days. So we're mindful of that, and I guess I think we're just looking for like good stuff all the time, and like when people bring good stuff and we, you know, we're into it, we want to, we do our best to support it and like figure out a way. Everybody that's here that's like a vested, you know, party in the restaurant is sort of came here and made their own job. Maybe they started as a pizza maker or even as a dishwasher or whatever. And sort of brought a special thing to the table and got it recognized and like, and then nurtured and then protected. And then they just sort of become part of the larger thing. And like I think we try and give it maybe a little direction and watch the various trains so that they don't fall off the tracks. You know, we do our best anyway. Sometimes they do. And just sort of pay attention to like what makes the train run faster, more efficient, etc., and then sort of, you know, keep our eyes out for what slows it down or gets in its way and try and remove those obstacles. And
like, what would those be?
Because,
I mean, I don't know how you keep up with all the projects you have going on, but like, just for instance, like, what's the kind of stuff that, like, throws you guys for a loop? Because it doesn't seem like anything stops this.
Well, I mean, one time they stopped the farm from being built up there, you know. It could be the city.
That took about 30 seconds to resolve.
Well, yeah, we just sort of pulled out. I mean, we're kind of, I think the good thing we got going is we get a little fanatical about projects, and that sort of, we just sort of we mobilized, you know. I mean, we were like, I think we like a good fight. So like, we that seemed like a good fight, you know.
Yeah.
It got picked with us, and like we just kind of pulled out all the stops.
First blood.
Yeah, and you know, and like, it's a weird thing when you're doing projects, and for us, it's worked well to adopt that kind of mentality or approach to it, and then, you know, of course, you have to not get consumed by wanting a good fight all the time. So the hardest thing about running this circus is sort of constantly getting yourself back in check and remembering that, you know, these are projects and these are things that we're doing, but they don't supersede the more important stuff, like, you know, trying to live in a way that you can live with.
You can have fun.
Yeah.
Well, now you guys, I mean, you have the Brooklyn Grange is up and running and obviously doing well. This is the first weekend there hasn't been a market. So I guess
this
the growing
urban
season
is
kind of over.
In, Queens. In
yeah, Ireland. There's Ben's got a bunch of carrots, but they're...
But that was wildly successful. I mean, that was remarkable that just went from like zero to 60. I mean, by midsummer, you guys were growing, selling produce already.
Yeah.
Which, and how much of that was supplying the restaurant?
Here, I don't even know what the percentage was.
Sort of self-sustainable with that, or?
Is it the restaurant? No, not even close. Uh-huh. It's obviously, any step in that direction is the right direction, but it, no, I mean, I don't even know what the percentage is. It was a small percentage of the amount of food that we moved through here. But
right. When
you tally up all of the restaurants who got involved, and then the success of the public markets, especially as the season wore on and people kind of started
got to know it better.
Yeah, exactly. It started to make an impact, and more importantly than that, even as far as how many people could feed, because it's an acre, and you can feed a good amount of people with an acre. But you know, it's New York City. I mean, it's a little bit of a drop in the bucket, but it you know, from a pure like logistical or bean counting standpoint. But as an idea, as something that was a kind of wild idea that could be expanded to that size and then executed, even in the face of you know, of some adversity, that to me is where its value is sort of like off the chart. And it's going to be interesting to see this year coming what the follow-ups are. And
totally.
A lot of people have contacted us in the last year and, you know, told us about their intentions to do similar projects, some of them even more ambitious. And that's all, you know, all over the world. And that's awesome. And the meter's running on that, you know. Let's see how far this whole thing goes.
Talking about meter running, I mean, how do you judge when you're overextending yourself? Because you have such a wild team. Like, how do you judge that fine line that you're making sure you're not too little butter spread over too much toast?
We constantly get too little butter spread over too
very
much toast.
Nice.
I know, you're always ahead. Right?
Well,
you're always a project
ahead of what the infrastructure can support.
Yeah, that's what it seems.
Yeah, I don't know how to slow it down. It's... Because it already feels slow because the executions aren't on pace with the ideas. And then, of course, the infrastructure and the like organizational and operational stuff that back up the finished, you know, the birth of a new thing, that's always lagging behind. I don't know, man. I mean, we're always looking for more people and the right kind of people to do more stuff. And it's...
It's an empire. It's like a little growing empire
It's wild
going there.
And unruly. And we just, you know what it is? It's a giant horse that we just like try and stay on as it like gallops.
Let's talk a little bit about, because you guys have another project coming up down. Sarah was telling me down at in Miami.
Yeah.
You guys are doing you've been invited to do a concession at Art Basel, which is one of the biggest art fairs in the United States every year.
For Scope, actually, which runs
that
at the same time.
Yeah.
It's a separate fair, but it's like a younger, edgier.
Uh-huh. How did that
happen? I
guess
more streetwise art fair that runs while Basel's going on. That came to us through Jason and Jeremy at Third Ward, and they've been involved with it for a number of years now. And you know, they got asked to do the food stuff, and we're like, though they came to us, and they're like, "Hey, man, the food down there in the past has sucked and we don't want it to anymore."
In a word,
so
yeah.
Can you do something?
So what are you guys going to do? You're just going to do pizzas down there? Or
no, we're not going to do any pizza.
It's Gabe McMackin. That's the most exciting project is now the catering thing. Because all of a sudden it's like the outreach.
Because, I mean, pretty soon you're going to be rivaling Sodexo.
Yeah.
With these offsites.
I mean, why not? Somebody's
exactly.
Got to do it.
Gabe at the university cafeteria. That'd
yeah,
be cool.
Right?
Gabe McMackin, fantastically talented dude, wants to, or is heading our catering department. And this was like, you know, the catering motto is anything, anytime, anywhere, and like this sort of fit perfectly into that. Of course, the first reaction is yes, and then the next reaction right after that is, holy shit, how are we gonna do this?
Yeah, what are we and what? No,
You know, but we got the team together. We got a plan, and we're going to go down there and do it.
So what kind of menu are you going to offer?
And where do you
rent
this
like similar to
It's going to be very, very Asian-influenced.
Really?
Yakitori is going to be the centerpiece of the cooking. And then we're gonna do a pastry and coffee thing inside the tent, and then out on the deck outside, which I think is gonna be awesome because there's gonna be a live stage set up next to it and a big bar, and it should be a kind of awesome party every day that we're there. But outside we're gonna do yakitori.
What is yakitori?
Rice bowls,
like sushi,
skewers, grilled skewers. Skewer,
it's meat, sweetie.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's fan. I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah,
it's
no, in the Japanese yakitori. To come now up I know with what like it is.
The best grilling thing ever.
Yeah, so you're just gonna have a bunch of little grills basically then.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't have to invest in a big kitchen setup or anything. You can just rent some grills, chuck them in
there. Yeah, and then we are talking to. I think this is going to happen. I think Electrolux is going to let us use their test kitchen in Miami, in Fort Lauderdale, to do all the like big commissary style stuff.
How many people are you going to be feeding?
30,000 over 5 days. Is what
we've
been
told.
That's
a lot.
Yeah, so it's like...
I'd be having a freaking heart attack right about now.
Yeah, we're having heart attacks. But, it's... It's going to be an interesting project, I think...
I wouldn't even know how to order for that. Like, 30,000 people over 5 days?
We
wow.
Need to find somebody to help. No,
that's you just really
seems like
something.
You're trying to get gigs along your sailing route.
Yeah.
Right. You're going to take
New York
the boat
to
down?
Miami, man. I'm going to go for the records. Yeah.
Now, Carlos got family in Panama, right?
Yeah.
So, do they let little sailboats go through there?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, anything,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, you go through with the bigger guys, but
and
yeah.
And then you just have to make an appointment to go through, or
exactly.
They make you wait?
You usually have to wait. A few days to a few weeks, depending on
really?
How much traffic is going through. And there are a lot of guys that hang out on both ends looking to be picked up as crew if you're undercrewed for the thing. Because you need a good amount of crew for like all of the rope work that needs to be done as you go from lock to lock. And, this is all, I've never done it, obviously.
Okay.
This is what I hear. So yeah, you pick up, if you're undercrewed, you pick up crew members to make the passage through the canal with you.
Guys?
Yeah,
I just flew over Panama, the canal, a couple weeks ago, and it was the craziest thing I've ever seen, seeing all these like boats as big as skyscrapers just all hanging out in like an armada in like one place.
And they're all waiting to get through?
They're all just chilling, yeah, and they're all gigantic. It's crazy.
Wow, that's interesting.
I've seen some of those scary big boats in Newport Harbor in Rhode Island, too. Because these cruise lines come into Newport and they dock there for a couple of days and let people go to the breaker, all the big mansions and everything. And they are. They're
amazing.
They're like floating skyscrapers. Yeah,
yeah.
And they sometimes have as many as like 20,000 people on board. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, they're wild.
It's bigger than my hometown for sure. Yeah.
And have you ever gotten anything going in New Mexico, didn't you? Or in Austin? You've always been wanting to go down to the foam festival there, right?
Yeah. I mean, for this is one of those like now it's just I don't know. We talked for years about going to Austin for South by Southwest. And then, in the early days of Roberta's, when it was more just pizza focused, we used to talk about the rock and roll pizza tour and like the mobile oven, going from city to city, like touring, get a bunch of bands together and do a tour where we cook the food for it. Could be a lot of fun still. There's so
that
much other
still
stuff.
Happen.
Yeah, but it's funny how like you have an idea and then something happens along the way, some opportunity that is a kind of like evocative enough of that initial impulse, but it's different. Like for us, so we didn't go on Rock and Roll Pizza Tour and we didn't go to Austin, but now we're going to Miami. And
that's pretty good.
It's like,
yeah,
it's cool.
Feeding 30,000 people in
so
5 days.
Can we talk
you
about
do
some
like
of the
challenge.
People at Roberta's, like some of the people behind the scenes? I mean, like for instance, Josh.
Corey.
Yeah. Like that's really cool to have a true artisan basically working full time. Like what types of role does he fill? Like how is a guy like that necessary to your work?
Oh, man. He's so necessary. I mean, he has more work than a human being could possibly do in a day.
What does Josh do for you?
He's like the on-site carpenter, designer. He's going to hate me for this. Handyman. He's not a handyman at all, although he is the guy we lean on when things go wrong. I mean, in the early days, it was Brandon and I fixing all this stuff, but we're just too busy now. And frankly, he blows us away and is really good at what he does. So it's like, and that's kind of what's happened here, like we'll start the thing off and then people come out that can do it way better than us and they want to do it. And we're like, yeah, please. And so
right.
Josh is that guy in the building department.
Now, how proud have you been of the kitchen and how that's transformed? Because there were the old days where they would bring a Boston yeah. butt in the L train, you know, after having yeah. cooked it at home. And now this is competing for actually best restaurant in New York now. People are voting
yeah,
for it.
Yeah, on eater.com. We were just looking at the poll. Yeah.
Vote for Roberta's restaurant.
Yeah, go to your computer now.
How has it changed? I mean, it's turned into a world-class one-star Michelin or something type
Maybe,
restaurant.
Maybe someday. I mean, those guys are just badasses, man. They're... I mean, you know, Carlo started doing great things with nothing. And I think, and then somebody else came along and was like, hey, this is awesome. Like, let me help. And he just put together this crack team. And all the while, he got better at what he was doing. And then we got a little bit of money, just a little, but enough to, like, you know, build his kitchen up and give him some real equipment. And then, of course, when you can do something with nothing, when you get something, mm-hmm. you ought to be able to do something amazing. And, you know, and they do every night.
Yeah.
Tell us about Ulysses. He's been most kick-ass.
I love that guy.
Kick-ass runner of all time.
I don't know what we'd do without Ulysses either.
He's been around for a long time.
He has, man. He's just a really cool guy. Like,
he's nice.
He's a fun guy to be in a room with, you know.
Yeah. Good energy. Yeah. And then, man, the waiters and waitresses, I mean, I probably remember 100 of them by name. I mean, first of all, Francis, what a great hire he was.
Yeah.
He's been with us since the beginning.
Since the very beginning.
He started as a pizza. Hello.
Yeah. And then Lacey, the waitress. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. How lovable
Love her.
Is she?
Love her. And Dawn.
And Francesca, who went up to Yale. I mean, there is like a whole community of art and culture, you know, right through there. They really get the best of the best.
But I think that's what makes Roberta such a really lovely place to come because
Thanks.
They are
They found
really,
us, too.
They're like, really nice people and it's a pleasure to interact with them. So it creates this kind of nexus of good energy and good vibe, man. You know, I always say this place is like on one of those harmonic convergence meridians, you know, where all things good happen. It just seems like everything here just explodes into something even better. And just
Brandon
gets
says
as it
it's
goes.
A Pegasus landing ground.
Yeah, right. It's magical.
Any new things? We have a couple minutes left. I mean, fun things that you feel. I mean, you're the king of keeping things secret. You know, big projects, and then all of a sudden we'll read about it. People read about it in the Times or something like that. But do you have any other things like?
Best Pizza just opened.
Okay.
Go check it out. I'm going to plug Best Pizza here. It's a slice joint.
I thought we were keeping that the best kept secret.
We worked really hard to not tell anyone about that until it was
really
open.
Hard.
Yeah, it's good.
It's
yeah.
really hard to do that.
So Best Pizza's on Wyckoff and...
Havemeyer. Between North 7th and North 8th.
Sorry,
it's in Kenny's old brick oven gallery, and then which became Brooklyn Star under Kino Baca, and then... they moved on to a bigger space after their fire. Mm. And as a joke, Kino was here one day and I said, you know, we should open a slice joint in there.
Oh, that's Kino who runs that. Okay. He used to be with Mama Fuko and all those guys. Yeah, yeah. He's Josh's good friend. That's great.
Great cook. Had a great little restaurant. Is going to have the great little restaurant again in just a slightly bigger space. So he called me up and was like, hey, man. Absolutely, like let's do slices in here. And we had Frank, we'd already met Frank through Anthony Falco, Frank Pinello, who's the head pizzaiolo down at Best Pizza and whose pizza you're eating. Total badass rock star pizza maker from Bensonhurst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so legit that like there's nothing more to say about it.
So basically people heard it here first, Best Pizza on Havemeyer.
Actually, well, Florence Fabric came out
did
yeah.
she?
By a
oh,
couple
all
weeks.
Right, then.
Sorry, Flo Jo, she's still at it.
Flo Fab.
She'll be long after we're all dead. She'll still be scurrying around the restaurant scene helping us. I'd like to have her on.
God bless her. She's
awesome,
great.
Well, yeah. Chris,
she's fabulous.
We have to, at the very minimum, once a season, but hopefully more. And either in December or with our new season in January, you know, we'd love to.
Yeah, come back and let's hear what's in the pipeline for the next summer.
Always hear what's in the pipeline.
Because I know
yeah,
there's
definitely.
Something else brewing, for
and
sure.
And thanks so much officially for letting this exist and being so supportive of it and allowing this archive to grow of information. You know, hopefully 100 years from now, you know, kids will still be logging onto this site and learning things about... cool thing. So
yeah. Awesome.
The king of DIY.
Power to your empire.
The emperor. Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Whatever.
With Josh Sharkey from Bar Kata.
Packed all your things and gave me your ring. Said, honey, I'm leaving for good.
We're back. I'm so sorry I was late, Katie. But I'm sure you did a great 10 minutes.
That's never happened before. I know. You know, it's got to happen once in a while. It's no problem, Patrick.
You got me right back into the flow.
Yeah, yeah, you were
so
great.
So today we're sponsored by Sam Edwards, S. Wallace Edwards and Sons of Surrey, Virginia, who make amazing prosciuttos. And they also make now a peanut-fed line of Heritage pork.
Yeah.
So we're very proud of them. We just had Matt Weingarten and Chris Parachini, two guys, really awesome guys.
Awesome. Awesome.
And now we have Josh Sharkey, who is used to be a Franny's. I think that's how we met. Or I don't know. Oh, no, through Cafe...
Well, Cafe Gray is the last place.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Cafe Gray, right? And then, I don't know.
Actually, Patrick, I met you about 10 years ago in Torino at this Sloan.
Oh, yes, that's true. But then, now, Bark Hot Dog, what an awesome place. If I lived within a mile of there, I would eat there 4 times a week. It's like an everyday type of thing. And it's so pioneering to make a sustainable hot dog themed joint. I mean, tell us a little bit about how that all started and how it's going.
Well, I think the way it started is, you know, I mean, my background is mainly in fine dining, and my business partner, Brandon, who is from Franny's, you know, we both, you know, came up in that kind of, you know, in that industry of fine dining. We realized that there was a missing gap of just good food, you know, that wasn't in that atmosphere. And, you know, I think we also, you know, living in Park Slope, you know, seeing, you know, a lot of children and a lot of, you know, young professionals, you know, I think every time we would see someone going to a fast food joint or someplace that, you know, obviously is not, you know, the greatest food in the world, kind of really struck a chord with us. And we kind of wanted to change the perception of what fast food is.
Now, how do you make margins on what is traditionally conceived as such a cheap food?
Well,
I think a hot dog could cost $1.50 somewhere.
That for us is the most difficult challenge, I think, because, you know, and that's really the only, you know, I think the only problem we've, you know, come across. I mean, obviously there's a lot of problems, but that come across in a restaurant, but the price point is definitely tough because, you know, we're really product driven, and it's really important to us to use the best products we can, and that's just not something that's ever happened with fast food. So, you know, and especially with hot dogs are usually fillers with, you know, cheap cuts of meat, and you have you know, unheard of things in your hot dog. And
it's actually a true example of biodiversity. It's a hot dog. It's got everything in it.
Every conceivable species.
So we spent a lot of time, you know, finding the right, you know, the right.
So you guys are not making your own hot dogs.
No, we actually work.
It's very hard to make hot dogs.
It's you have to have a good fine grind and what natural casings. I mean, it's not that hard.
The emulsification is the big part of it.
Tell our listeners what that is and me.
Well, I mean, hot dogs, you know, usually. It's an emulsified meat, almost like, well, I mean, there's always a little bit of liquid in there, water. Usually it's water or ice.
So you make like a slurry?
Well, it's not really a slurry, but I mean, the water is used to kind of, well, two things. One, to emulsify the fat that's in the dog, and also it also with most hot dogs kind of gives you a little bit more weight.
Right.
So tell us the tell us the process of making a hot dog, and then to contextualize it.
Well, I mean, for us, our hot dog is really only three cuts of meat. It's pork shoulder, pork jowl, and beef shoulder. That's it. Those are the only three cuts that we use in our hot dog. And then really the seasoning is really, really, really light. The salt, a little bit of pepper, some coriander, and that's it, really.
No mustard?
Not in the actual hot dog. You know,
slurry, yeah. In the mix.
It's really just meat, salt, and...
And where does this get ground? So you get these things, and are you allowed to say the ratio, or...?
Well, it's a proprietary blend, so...
So then when you mix it, into a big vat?
Well, Joseph Bruno, the gentleman who makes it for us upstate, he just switched to a larger facility. He went from a 3,000 square foot, like a 15,000 square foot facility.
Wow, good for you.
But he's, you know, he makes it in 1,000-pound batches. So it's these giant, basically it's like a giant buffalo chopper, which is just almost like a grinder. So it goes to two processes, the buffalo chopper and then the fine grind. And it's really, you know, it's all ground together, mixed, emulsified, and then it's shot out in, you know, in portion size, you know,
Which is what, a 4 ounce dog or something?
Well, ours are 7 to a pound.
Okay.
So
you can buy a 1 pound hot dog at Bark?
No. It's 7 hot dogs per pound.
Oh, I see.
So
okay, gotcha.
Usually, most sausages you count, you know, per pound. So it's 6 a pound. Or our sausages, like the bratwurst and the vice versa, are 4 to 5 a pound, depending.
And they're made in the same place?
They're made at the same place.
How did you meet that guy?
I mean, I'll be honest. We tasted so many hot dogs before we opened Bark, and you know, obviously tried making our own, and really. It's not something that we could have sustained for the amount that we go through in a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I had actually met with Ariane from D'Artagnan at Blaugowns for a meeting because we were talking about possibly doing a hot dog together, and then when we had lunch, I had actually had a sausage there, and Kurt Gutenberg, the guy who's the chef there, was. Told me that the sausage that they were using was made by this guy, this Austrian
gentleman. Meeting with Ariane.
Yeah, which is kind of funny.
That's funny. Did you just leave the meeting once you tasted the hot dog? You just left her there with the check?
Well, no, we actually went through a couple of different tastings with Ariane. Didn't really, work out the way we wanted. I think she still has a hot dog now, which doesn't have nitrates in it. But, for me, I think, you really need the nitrate to make it work.
Now, that's an argument.
You need it to
what
be
is
pink?
The advantage
well, I mean,
versus either way?
Well, here's the thing is if you're not going to use nitrates, and what Ariane does, and any hot dog you see that doesn't have nitrate, is they use a large amount of celery, like the celery product or the celery juice, or because celery itself has a fair amount of nitrates in it. Yeah.
Cool.
But, nitrates are used to preserve the meat, and also it gives you that nice pink color. And if you don't have enough of it, they don't last as long for one.
And you don't hold them that long, so that's not the issue for you.
Well, I mean, really, after you open up our hot dogs come in what's called a negative air package. Directly to Bark, so it takes out all the air. Unlike Cryovac, where you take out all the air and it's just there's no air in the package, this takes out the air and then it adds nitrogen. As soon as you open that package or any package, the meat starts to deteriorate. After 2 days, it's not the same as it was.
How many do you have Cryovac to a pack? 5 or 10?
It's a 5 pound pack, so it's 35.
35 at a time. So when you open to get one, there's 34 that are out.
Exactly. Well, I mean, we go through it very fast.
Right.
But even I'd rather not open a pack and have it sit overnight. Honestly, it doesn't change that much. But
so you 86 it, as they say.
No, we just manage it well, so we know how much to use. But the nitrate for me is really important. It also does help a little bit with the flavor. There's obviously salt. In nitrates, most nitrates you use, if you're going to use pink salt, it's like 96% salt, 4% nitrite. So you're going to get a good amount of salt in there as well, which obviously helps with the flavor. I think for the main thing that Joseph's hot dogs, that he really had the best, the meatiness that we were looking for with the salt content that we wanted. And then, we kind of applied, we based all of our hot dogs with this smoked lard butter that we make. We basically just buy your fat back from Heritage and smoke it overnight and then whip that with butter and salt. And so everything at Bark, it's basted with that before we bring it out. So just to give it a little bit more smokiness and salt to it.
So let me ask. So then he does it in that big buffalo grinder, and then he gets casings from these big, like the Case King or these big companies that produce most of the country's casings?
Yeah, well, he uses lamb casing.
Oh, okay.
Which is really, if you're making a hot dog, it's really the only, first for the size, it's really all you can use unless you're going to do something synthetic. So all of his hot dogs are
so you have natural casings on your hot dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you really, if you want the right snap, you have to have it.
So yeah, you need the snap, and then you get it basically there because he takes this emulsified thing and puts in the casing, and then cooking it. Is it are there secrets that are people at home that you would tell them, hey, don't grill it?
Well, it's certainly not a secret. We're pretty open about it. The way that we cook the hot dog, which I think it's important the way that you cook it. We, I think a lot of people, and even the hot dog that we have is Austrian in style, and the way that they usually cook that is boiled. But we slowly roast it on the griddle. It slowly renders on the griddle at a low temperature to kind of render that casing and get it, you know, nice and tender and crispy. And then we finish it really hot, so it gets that nice bite to it. And then we, you know, obviously with the smoky lard butter at the end. Mm-hmm. But it's, I think the most important part is to really slowly render the hot dog so that, you know, you can get the casing nice and tender and crispy.
I kind of want to go there right after.
I know, it sounds absolutely fantastic.
Hot dog is such a great friggin' food.
I cannot eat hot dogs normally because typical commercial hot dogs are made with mustard, which I'm wildly allergic to.
You mean mustard seed?
Yeah.
Really?
That's one of the seasonings in typical.
You're allergic to mustard, huh?
Yeah, it's such a drag. You have no idea.
Yeah, I think, you know,
lactose intolerant. I used to be that too.
The spices, I think, are one thing that I disliked about a lot of the hot dogs that I ate was, mm-hmm. you know, you don't really taste the meat so much because there's so many spices and things in there. And that's what I liked about Joseph's, you know, style was he was very, very simple.
Very minimalist.
What's the best just industrial hot dog for people that can't come to Bark and they might be listening in Kansas City?
They can actually buy, Hartman's makes, you know, hot dogs. I think Wegmans sells them.
Oh, I love Wegmans.
So, yeah, you can certainly get his. And I think, you know, other than that, to be honest with you, if you want a good hot dog, I recommend just going to a Polish butcher if you have one near you. Because mm-hmm. they always have, you know, really good beany, smoky.
That's not for just hot dogs, for all good quality things, Poles.
Yeah. All good quality meat things, yeah.
So is there a website down. And tell us your address and all that for the archive?
Well, it's Bark Hot Dogs is the website, barkhotdogs.com.
And it's on a weird little street that's between Flatbush and 5th?
It's on Bergen Street, yeah, between Flatbush and 5th. We have a Facebook page and you know, we're starting to grow. We wanted to take it very slow in the beginning. We're only a year old, but now that we're starting to grow, we'll have some more. We'll probably do a little bit more, you know, with Twitter and things like that. But
can you open on Court and 4th Place? Is that possible?
Well, you know, we're looking near
them. How about the Upper West Side?
You know, it's funny when we first opened, there was a lot of people would call us and you know, when are you going to come to the Upper West Side?
It's not that easy.
No.
Would you ever do like a cart?
I mean,
take a page out of the Roberta's book and like, I mean, they've got the portable pizza oven and you know.
Well, franchise. I mean, I think the connotation of franchising to, you know, give this to somebody else to kind of run it. I don't think that's something that we're looking to do right away, or maybe not at all. But we're certainly expanding. I mean, this business is economy to scale. You know, it's meant to expand. We've always planned from the beginning to have more, but we wanted to know before we moved on that everything was, you know, all the systems were in place and that we were happy with the consistency. And I think, you know, we're certainly, you know, very, very close to that now. We're entertaining a lot of offers for new projects. And I don't want to see too much, but we, you know, definitely have some stuff.
You'll be seeing Bark Hal somewhere else. Well, Josh, we'd love to have you come back on. We'd love to have you with Brandon and talk also about the whole history. Maybe we could do a little tasting or something, but maybe we could broadcast from there. But it's a real breaking new ground, making sustainable food accessible. We didn't even get to talk about sourcing and all that, although you guys buy from Heritage, and I know many other good sources. But anyway,
it's
more
just
power
a good reason to,
you. To
have you back.
Every neighborhood in the country deserves a Bark, and I guarantee you the fast food franchises would poop their pants if they knew that 40 Barks were opening in Cleveland or something. So good luck, and we hope to have you back.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks
guys.
A lot
Appreciate
for stopping
it.
By, Josh.
Thank you.
I went across to Switzerland where all the yodelers be to try to learn the yodel with the yodel I climbed a big high mountain on a clear and sunny day and met a yodeling guy up in that little Swiss chalet. Oh, he taught me to yodel, 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 he taught me to yodel, yodel, we'll be right back.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We were just talking with Josh Sharkey from BARC. Before that, our guests have been Chris Barachini of Roberta's and Matt Weingarten, who came to us from
Sodexo.
So next up, we are inaugurating a new series. And I should say, this is the main course.
Tim must be so
Heritage
honored.
Heritage Radio Network. Oh, I hope so. And this is the first of our new series, which is to explore other cities. Why am I getting feedback, laddies?
Yes, like Washington, D.C.
He's listening to the stream. He needs to turn his computer down.
Tim, you have to turn your computer down.
I don't have a computer on.
All right. Well, let's get into it.
Okay, anyway, D.C. So Tim is the food writer you're the restaurant critic for the Washington City Paper, and you have a blog called Young and Hungry, right?
Correct. It's more middle-aged and hungry, but we like to pretend.
Well, we pretend that we're young and hungry because that's the way we are right here. Patrick, of course, is an infant. I myself am way beyond the century mark. But that being said, we try to keep it young at heart. And Tim, thanks so much for being so patient with us today. I'm sorry we were a little discombobulated.
I miscalculated the time change.
Yes, Patrick
had
a...
Do not worry about it.
He had a horological mishap.
Okay, so how long have you been in the industry, and what do you tell us a little bit about the column? And I'm fascinated by DC food culture because it seems like such a transient community in general. So have there been, like, what are the true deep-rooted traditions of Washington, DC, I guess, is my question.
Okay. So many questions. Which one would you want me to tackle first?
What is the roots? What is the roots of DC cuisine? Because if it's such a transient community, like New York, we know, San Francisco, we know. What is DC's oldest and most hallowed restaurants?
Well, DC, as you rightly suggest, hasn't really had a deep and abiding food culture like maybe the South. Even though we're technically considered part of the South, it has been a transient culture and continues to be a fairly transient culture. So I don't think DC, you can point to any particular a food or product and say this is a distinctly DC food. I mean, there have been... I actually did a project last year to name DC's signature dish, and it was all over the map, you know. And
no one thing stood out?
It went from everything from like the Senate Navy Bean Soup, which, you know, technically is really only available to people who can go to the Senate cafeteria, and has only marginally trickled out into the restaurants, and it's not very good.
I have a recipe for that.
To the Half Smoke, which is, of course, what Ben's Chili Bowl serves, and Ben's has become, through President Obama, you know, kind of like the signature restaurant of D.C.
And what is that restaurant?
It's really just a soul food slash diner down on U Street. And that has become like the place where all the tourists go.
Wow.
And, you know, it's really a classic throwback. I mean, I love Ben's. It's a classic throwback diner. It has the stools along the counter. It's got the illuminated menu board above the grill, behind the counter, and it's just hamburgers, hot dogs, sausages, french fries, milkshakes, breakfast foods, and yet it's become an institution in D.C. because it has survived.
Now,
and that's one thing that just doesn't, you know, D.C. doesn't, a lot of institutions don't survive. Things change so rapidly around here.
Well, like you, for a while, were the preeminent food city in the country, I believe, with Jean-Louis Paladin, didn't he
and
set
you
up there?
And still have, he was there, and Michel Richard with Citron.
But then,
right.
as you
and
say,
you
those
have
things
Jose Andres
ended.
Now.
But are those places still in business?
Michel Richard is still going strong.
Of course, Jean-Louis passed many years ago. But he was like the first celebrity chef, if you know, before even anyone used that term around here, and worked down to the Watergate and made a terrific name for himself and really probably put D.C. on the map back when French food was the style and everyone wanted to eat French food. And, of course, historically, D.C. has, its restaurant culture has been French food and or steakhouses, and they've been very pricey and probably out of the reach of the average sort of diner unless you had an expense account or worked for the government or a lobbyist or a lawyer.
But, is there anybody else?
The celebrity chef culture in this town has just exploded, and you know we still have Michelle Richard who has kept DC as his home base, but I dare say he's been eclipsed in popularity and probably relevance by Jose Andres.
Yes,
who he's a real
now, of
yeah,
course,
force.
Is just everywhere. He's opened the place in Los Angeles, the Bazaar, which got 4 stars immediately out of the box, which I think everyone was surprised by, and now
four
it's looking
stars by
at
the Post.
Las Vegas, which of course is the hallmark of being a celebrity chef, I guess.
I guess.
No, Vegas is.
It's the hallmark of the celebrity chef who sort of franchises out his name, something like that, right?
Right, right.
I have my doubts about how high the quality has to be.
To his credit.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those guys do stay involved, but it's very hard. I think very hard. I remember visiting Tom Colicchio's kitchen out there when he opened up a craft steak or something like that. And you know, his chef de cuisine was like, I can't even keep help here. I mean, it's like the transient population. You think it's bad in D.C. And in Vegas, it's like people come, people go from week to week. So trying to maintain the quality of your kitchen staff and thus the quality of your food, I think, is a real challenge out there.
Can I ask one question? Is there a food quality change during administrations? I mean, can you point to the culinary culture of D.C. going up during Democratic administrations and down during Republican
nice.
Ones? I mean, or is there a change at all? If not hierarchical, I mean, is there any change at all?
Well, I it'd be nice to say, at least for my lefty little heart, that the Democrats bring better food, but that's not really the case. I think D.C., as far from as the restaurant culture is concerned, has really mushroomed in the last 10 to 15 years. I came to D.C. in 2001 and considered like an old timer around here now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you see, if you judge a restaurant scene by its stamp of celebrity chefs, we've certainly have become, have raised a couple of notches in the country's esteem. You know, we've got a flood of New York chefs have come down here. I mean, Eric Repair and Alan Ducasse and Bobby Flay. I don't know where Bobby Flay is where his home base is. But all these chefs have opened up restaurants or will be opening up restaurants in the city soon. And I think it says less that they think that we are a sophisticated culinary town, although I think we're getting there, and more about that we've got money because we're the seat of government. And unlike a lot of cities, our recession hasn't been probably we haven't been hit as hard as other cities have.
Yeah, government keeps on churning along no matter what. Tim, let's talk a little bit about sort of like in New York. I mean, we just had one of our guests on was Chris Parrachini, and Chris is kind of the emperor of DIY here in Brooklyn. And, he and his partners opened up this rooftop farm called the Brooklyn Grange. And they're one of many rooftop farms that are opening up here in the New York, the five borough area. Do you have a similar kind of surge towards urban agriculture and
bottom
local
up,
stuff.
Kind of build your own restaurant in the outskirts.
In the D.C. area, or is it still really pretty much controlled by big restaurant groups and smaller independents?
Well, I think D.C. Restaurant culture is a little different in that the downtown real estate and the D.C. itself, the real estate in D.C. is very expensive. So, not that New York isn't very expensive too, but most of the restaurants you see in like downtown and some of the more popular neighborhoods like Adams Morgan and U Street and downtown, it's like they're very self-contained and small restaurants, and that's where a lot of the kind of the heart of the restaurant culture lives. Now there's stuff kind of out in the suburbs. But it's not, it's kind of scattered here and there, and some of those places, I think, like Cahal Armstrong, who owns Restaurant Eve, has developed sort of his own not farm, but he's developed his own sort of like garden that he pulls from. But it's not any sort of major project. Like I know there's a chef who works for a restaurant called Post Brasserie down in Penn Quarter who has turned his whole outdoor patio essentially into an outdoor garden. And you can dine among it. And he's got hundreds of plants now, and he uses it in his kitchen. But I don't think it's the same thing as what you're talking about, but it's probably as close as DC comes to that concept.
Wow. That's very different from here. I mean, Patrick has a question, and then I'm going to follow up. Go ahead, Patrick.
Oh, no, you go.
Well, I was going to say that being as how you're in Virginia, and actually one of the guys that Patrick works with at Heritage Foods USA is a Virginia farmer named Alec Bradford. You know, that whole area that Alec lives in, which is near Blacksburg, is kind of a hotbed of you know, farmers who are working with a natural model.
Small independent farmers, yeah. Along the Allegheny Trail, you know.
And how Blue much Ridge of Mountains. That food is coming into the DC restaurant
scene.
Yeah,
are there alternative sources, or are you still dominated by the big three? Yeah.
Oh, no. You know, a lot of the independent restaurants, and even the larger restaurant groups, they really have worked hard at forging good relationships with area farmers. I mean, mm-hmm. like every other city around, you know, local seasonals, like the drumbeat mantra that everyone is espousing here. And I think it's even gone further. There's a chef here named Todd Gray who has developed his own cattle.
Oh, and cool.
Has bought like a small, if I remember this correctly, has bought a small herd of cattle and raises it, you know, according to his own standards.
That's fascinating.
And feed, and then, you know, has to go to the USDA slaughterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
But the cattle is raised to his specifications, and then it's cut to his specifications.
And his genetics.
He actually has his own beef, which I think is pretty cutting edge.
Yeah, no, that's very
cool. Actually, I'd like to talk to him.
Cutting edge.
Let's talk after the show, Tim. I'd like to get his information.
In terms of when I think of Washington D.C., I think of big institutions like the Smithsonian and such. And I was really impressed by the food cafeteria at the Museum of the Native American. I think that's what
it's called. That's what it's called.
And I wondered if you could speak to that culture, either that museum in particular, or, you know, with these hundreds of museums and all these tourists coming in, like, what are the eating options for, you know, for people who come in like that? And is that part of what you write about in the paper?
You know, I really don't focus much on the cafes and cafeterias in the museums, mostly because they have been so, you know, quick service and processed and prepackaged foods. But I you know, what you're talking about, the American Indian Museum, they really did raise the bar. The chef, in fact, just came out with a cookbook of his recipes, Richard Hetzler, I believe his name is. And, I mean, it literally just came out, and I think it speaks to the quality and raising the level of sort of tourist food along the mall, the National Mall, and what people are looking for. I mean, I think we're all kind of hoping that, you know, the rest of the Smithsonian Strip there will get the hint and maybe raise the level of some of the food down there.
Because then people would really go for lunch, you know, even Washington people, I bet, if it was, you know, spectacular enough.
Absolutely.
It'll be
interesting to see. They need to hire Sodexo or Bon Appetit.
Or it'll be interesting to see the first great chef that goes and says, I want the Museum of Air and Space, you know, give me that cafeteria. And what if a Batali did something like that? Or, you know, your people, Jose Andres down there. Very interesting. So tell us about...
Right. I mean, I think like Danny Meyer. Didn't Danny Meyer take over like the service at the
MoMA?
MoMA, right. Yeah. And sort of raised the bar for food and museums.
Absolutely. And the Natural History Museum, Alice Waters has been working, you know, hard because it was her favorite museum. You know, those in the end are the places that feed the most people. So it's interesting. So what restaurants have you written about recently? We have a couple more minutes. What restaurants would you recommend to us New Yorkers? We come down on that fast train. What are two or three, you know,
of your favorites right now?
Right now.
Oh, that's always a tough one. You know, Penn Quarter has really exploded. That's where Jose Andres has all his restaurants. He's kind of consolidated them down there. So if you're like coming down from another city, I think it's always good to get a sample of some of what he's doing, because it's not just his tapas, Spanish restaurant, Jaleo, but you can try Zatina. You can try his attempt at Mexican food, which is Oyamel, which is actually pretty good.
Boy.
And Oyamel, yeah. And then there's also his Latin American restaurant called Cafe Atlantico, which inside of it is the mini bar, which is almost impossible to get a reservation for since it's only six seats.
Six.
But there's also, I mean, I think...
Sorry, wow. Tim.
Six.
Talk
that's
about
tough.
Exclusive.
Yeah. Well, that's where he's doing all his experiments in gastronomy and
right.
And I know he hates this term, but molecular gastronomy.
I know. Wiley
why do they
hates
all hate
too,
that term when that's because they don't like Hervé Tisse or what?
I mean, think like, they say molecular doesn't sound like
it
delicious.
Doesn't sound sexy enough.
And they claim their food's delicious, which I agree with. It is. It can be.
It can be.
So something like that.
But I think it's just boys with their toys. Personally, I got my own little rant about molecular gastronomy and boys who play with that stuff. But you know. So, but what is it? It's called Penn Quarter. That's the area in D.C.?
Penn Quarter, right. It's an area. It's just a couple blocks north of the mall, so it's not too far for people to come down to D.C. to want to see the museums and then want to, you know, hit some nice restaurants up that way.
That sounds great. It's nice when it's all in one place. So you can really, like, cruise around and see who's got tables. And
so, Tim, when are you going to be able to come and be at Roberta's and do radio with us live? And we have more time to go through the full list and the whole D.C. food scene now and in the past and in the future.
Well, I would love to. I get up to New York. I have good friends up in New York, and we get up there. You're in New York, right?
We're in Brooklyn.
Okay. I have good friends up there. He actually owns a theater up in Williamsburg. Wonderful experimental theater. And so we get up there.
Yeah, we're like
here.
A few blocks
so
from there.
Next time up there, would love to hang out with you guys.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
Absolutely. We'll buy
you
a delicious pizza at Roberta's, and we'll have you live in studio. And we thank you so much for
inaugurating
on
our
and,
series, too, yeah. of exploring the food scene in cities around the United States. I think that's great, and I hope you'll come back and do it again soon, whether
my
you're
pleasure.
In town or not. But it's fun to check in with the you know boots on the ground and see what's happening in other cities. We get very New York-centric here, so...
All right,
sounds
well,
great.
We have been engineered by Jack Inslee. And
by Nat Wiener.
By Nat Wiener.
Produced by Jack Inslee. Produced. Our guests today have been Tim Carman. Tim, thanks so much. And Matt Weingarten.
Josh Sharkey.
Hey, Katie, I've got Dave Arnold on the line. He's upset about your molecular gastronomy.
Oh, he did not.
Bring him on.
Anyway, thanks for listening. Next week...
Next week we have Living Concrete, Carrot City, an exhibition at the New School. And we also have...
Jack will go through a one-hour listing of all the
of
shows
all the programs.
Backwards.
But no, we have some fun people on next week, so please do stay tuned. Or tune in again, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network, guys. Coming up next is Cutting the Curd. After that, We Dig Plants. And then we will see you guys on Monday for our lineup. Remember, follow us on Twitter @HRN Updates for giveaways, information, and news. Thanks, guys.